This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. Thank you for joining us for our broadcast and online Main Street across North Dakota. A lot of classrooms are empty these days, but instruction continues online. The pandemic forced public schools and universities to shift the way courses are taught, and the changes will likely be in effect until the threat of COVID-19 subsides. Minot's Barb Solberg knows about the challenges to move instruction from the classroom to wherever the student is. Back in 1999, she co-authored The Student Guide to the World Wide Web and WebCT. Today, we'll share the discussion she had with Main Street's Ashley Thornburg about online learning.
Barb, thank you so much for joining us today.
Well, thank you for asking.
Going back to the 90s, what made you want to write this book?
Technically, I did not want to write this book. This was not in my frame of mind at all. Actually, I was really quite busy working in my office trying to figure out the software and how I was going to go about training faculty and how do you teach an online class. And then they also had to put their online class together. So I had to teach them how to use the software, how to create the class, how to teach the class. And one day my phone rang, and there was a fellow from Harcourt College Publishers that was on the other end, and he was kind of picking my brain for a while, and a while means about 45 minutes. And I was thinking, I have to get to work. I mean, I have so much to do. Why are we having this conversation? And I didn't say that to him, but pretty soon he said, well, how long do you think it would take you to write this book? I said, and what book would that be? And he said, you know, we need a guide. We need a student supplement book that will go to students, and faculty can put it on their book list for students if they're going to be teaching a class that uses this software, and the students have to learn how to be able to do this. So we need a textbook that would be supplemental to any class that would teach them how to do that. Well, I thought long and hard about it because I was at the university in Minot, and I knew I couldn't do it during the day when I was at work, and was a little concerned about if I did do it on university computer and on their time, then they would own the book. And I thought, well, maybe the best thing for me to do is just to do it at home, which is what I did. Then I'd work all day and come home at night. And I had told Nick, the fellow who called me, I said, I'm going to have to let you know tomorrow because I have to think about this. And, you know, the interesting thing about that is we had a 28.8 modem then, which was, I mean, that was twice as fast as the 14.4. And, you know, people who are a lot younger, they don't even know what that is. But initially, we'd have to use the telephone and dial in yep. to the university and get on one of the servers and hopefully, or on one of the phone lines, and hope that all the lines weren't busy because maybe they only had 14 or 20 phone lines that were dedicated to people getting online. So I did this on a 28.8 modem at home. The goal was to FTP it to the Harcourt server in Florida. Well, that was a whole new learning curve for me. That was how it was done. So I had no intention of ever writing a book. But, you know, it was fun. I had a good time. I had no idea what it was going to look like. But when I was writing it, I kind of thought, this is what I would like that book to look like. And when it was all done and I got a copy of it, I went, oh, yeah, well, they saw the same thing. So, you know, it was an interesting process. And the university didn't own it. And I remember they said to me, meaning Harcourt, he said, well, you know, we'd like to just pay you a lump sum, you know, when you get this done. And I thought, well, you know, I think I'll take my chances and go for some royalties because by the time you'd pay me, you know, I'd be done with the book anyway. So what difference does that make? So that was a good choice on my part.
Yeah, I remember dial-up internet a little bit. Mm-hmm. When I was in junior high and even a little bit of high school, I think that there was still dial-up. I actually called up on YouTube noise of dial-up internet, and it was so funny because it took me right back to making sure that none of my siblings were on the phone. My parents didn't need the phone because, of course, it would tie up your phone line back then.
Mm-hmm. And one of the lines in the book says, you know, for troubleshooting, it says, you know, if you're having a hard time getting on, be sure you've turned your modem on.
Mm-hmm.
We had those little boxes that sat beside the computer, you know, and you had to turn it on. I mean, we don't even think about the modems on all the time.
So you wrote the portion of the book. There are two different authors on this particular one, and you wrote the portion on WebCT or course tools, which I now understand is called Blackboard Learning System and is owned by Blackboard. Is this correct?
You know, there were two leading softwares at the time. WebCT was one and Blackboard was the other.
Okay.
We were kind of in competition with each other. WebCT means Web Course Tools. It was written by Murray Goldberg, who was a professor at the University in British Columbia in Vancouver. And his intent was not to write software either. He was an IT instructor who wondered what it would be like if students could communicate, in an online fashion. Now, that's pretty broad thinking back in like 1995. And so he created these little course tools and he went to present at some conferences, and he carried the software on a floppy disk because that's what we had then.
Floppy disks.
Yeah, and then people were not so much interested in the research as they were in getting a copy of that floppy disk. So he started handing out floppy disks, and suddenly they would say, well, if it does this, why can't you make it do this? And so he started adding more things to it, and as things evolved, then you know, it became a much bigger piece than his initial plan was. It became pretty robust, and I remember at Minot State when we received the grant to put courses together to serve them online, we didn't know what kind of software to use. And so Larry Atwood, who was the IT director at the time, said, well, he'd heard about this software, and he would just put it on the server, and we should go, you know, learn what it was. And so that was really how the choice was made, and it was just kind of a fluke that there we were and it worked.
Fast forward 25 or so years and talk about exponential growth. I mean, online learning, of course, has been growing throughout the early 2000s, but then you throw in a global pandemic and take children out of traditional class settings and you have a massive amount of students learning online. When you were working in this in the late 1990s, did you ever expect this level of online learning?
I don't believe so. I mean, I think personally, you know, I was just so involved in making sure that I was getting my work done so that we could get these 24 classes online. And how would we even know what kinds of technologies would be available as the years rolled by? We did know that it was really a phenomenal thing to do. And I can say that Minot State was far ahead of its time and one of the early successes, I think, in online learning. So, and I don't think that was such a plan that we had. It just turned out that way, that whenever we would go to conferences, we were always ones that were in the lead with it. And I remember one of my colleagues said to me, you know, don't get so excited about the internet, Barbara. It's just a passing fancy. And so we had a little discussion about that. The passing fancy is just—it just keeps on growing and growing. And you know, now what we talked about then, we just is so commonplace now. I mean, we can take an online course on our phone.
I have three devices in my bedroom right now, in part because I'm working from home, that connect to the internet, and that's just in my room. And you know, we have another computer downstairs that's our normal home computer. I'm certain our TV, well, yeah, it must, because I watch Netflix like all the time. So There's just a lot of things connecting to the internet. I'm curious, when the book was being written, what were some of the things that you recall as being really top of mind to stress as important either to teachers and professors or to students?
You know, it was so basic. I mean, when I look back at the book and I'm trying to teach them how to make a download folder on their computer, you know, trying to explain to them what RAM is and what a modem is, and trying to write both for a Macintosh user and for a PC user, that it was just, it was so basic that, and then if you have to troubleshoot, how do you do that? We don't do those things anymore. We just have a, an expectation that people just kind of know how to do these things.
I loved seeing in the table of contents that there was a chapter heading on how to send an attachment. And I just think of all the young children and I know, and I mean, they're teaching me how to do stuff. I mean, I know how to send an email attachment, of course, but they know how to do this. I just think it's so funny that we used to have to teach people. This was in a textbook. How to send an attachment. Now it's just pops up when I take a screenshot. It asks me if I want to attach it to an email right away.
And you know, it was all so new. So new when we would even at the university have a computer lab. And to get kids in there so that they, the first thing you have to do is know where the on button was. So you could turn it on. You know, and what do you do? What do you click on first? And we had been such... I think our learning style made us probably linear learners, that I do this first, second, third, and fourth. And I think that's all changed. You know, we don't read left to right anymore. Kids today see the whole screen. They, I watch my grandkids play video games, and I'm starting up on the left-hand corner of the screen to figure out what I'm supposed to be doing, and they'll look at me and they'll say, you know, you're dead, Grandma. I just got you. I don't even know where they are on the screen yet, you know? So our whole approach to to those screens is so different.
Do you worry about that at all, your grandkids and all the other children out there, how much screen time there is?
Well, it, I think it depends on what they're doing on that screen. I see my grandkids doing, we think they're playing games, but, you know, they're building little towns and they're like Minecraft and they're figuring out what they're going to put where. So they're really doing some complex learning pieces that I don't think we recognize as a learning piece. And if they're not with somebody in the room, they may be playing with somebody who's someplace else. So they are having some of that interaction. And I think it's okay unless they're doing things that are not appropriate, unless they're not getting exercise, unless they're not having communication with their parents and their siblings. I mean, all of those pieces, I think, are really important to the social development of kids, and so we can't let them be on the screen all the time. But I spend a lot of time on the screen.
Yeah, I was talking to a friend of mine who is a high school Spanish teacher, and she was lamenting some of the things that are lost, like, and in particular when you're teaching another language, that conversation back and forth, and sometimes the body language that you use to help advance a conversation. But then she also was quick to mention that some of her students are opening up online in a way that they never did in front of another person, because there's a layer of, I don't know if it's anxiety removed or anonymity added. Of course, they're not anonymous, but if the other kids can't see or hear them make a mistake, there's that fear that's gone.
Well, absolutely. You know, I, having taught in a classroom, there are some students who are just intimidated by the presence of another student who has a more powerful persona or talks more, is, has more flair. And so they're very quiet. They're more introverted. But in an online environment, you know, you can present yourself without worrying about all those other pieces. And so I hear what she said. Boy, I sure do.
Have you paid close attention to how the state has dealt with online education during the COVID pandemic?
I'm not real sure what's happening with online classes at a university level. I just don't pay attention to that anymore. But I think with kids in public schools, I think it's real important for them to especially young learners. I don't know how you would teach a student how to read unless, you know, you were there with them. I don't know how to teach somebody how to read, but those early elementary years, I think, are just really important. You know, kids will work for the teacher. The teacher can be right beside them and give them instruction as they're working or making mistakes if they have a question. And that's a little more difficult, you know, if you're doing it online. And I think as they get a little older, and I'm not sure what I mean by older, but, you know, 11, 12, 13, some kids are so curious and so tenacious that they will find something they like and they will just hang on to it and learn it. And those make good online students. They're learning above and beyond what they would get in a regular classroom. So I still think it depends upon the student, the learner. What kind of a learner is this person? Because there are several different learning styles. And, you know, when you teach in a classroom, you try to construct lessons that touch on as many learning styles as you can. In an online environment, that's a little more difficult. For example, I'm thinking about some students learn haptically, you know, by writing and taking all the notes. And some are better off if you can sing some of the things to them. You know, I can remember the conjunction, junction.
What's your function? Hooking up words and clauses and phrases.
Yeah, you know, and so you try to incorporate all of those things and make it so that the learning is kind of fun as well. And I'm not sure, because I'm just not in that world right now, if those things are happening. Although I do have a friend who taught music, kindergarten and first grade music. And when they went into home learning this last spring, she had made videos and she sang the songs and had the kids, you know, asking them to sing along with her. So, you know, I'm sure all that is happening because there are so many technologies that they can use to create those lessons. But I'm not that well versed right now on exactly how it's all working.
How did you even get to teaching this software? Because you were teaching humanities.
Right.
So where did this jump happen?
You know, well, I have to go all the way back to the 80s. When my kids were small and I was at home and the school that we were in Stanley and the school system wanted to start an adult ed program. And so they called to ask me if I would put this together and teach it. And most of the adults needed to come to school at night. And I thought that'd be a good idea. I needed to get out of the house. So I went and started developing the program and they wanted to be sure that there were some computers there. These were the old Apple IIe's where you had floppy disks, one had the program, and when you put your data on and, you know, you shuffled between them. And I had no idea, you know, how this worked. So I remember I had to quickly try to learn it, and I would go into the superintendent's office because he had a computer, and I just kind of watch him in the back to see how it happened. And then we got a computer at home so I could learn better and be a little more adept at it. And then I remember my husband said to me once, I was also doing some writing for North Dakota Horizons and a couple of other magazines. And he said, you know, I think we should get you a Macintosh now with a hard drive. And I said, you know, I don't need that. I don't even know what a hard drive is. And so I just sort of gradually kept moving along with the way the technology was expanding. And then moved in and started teaching at Minot State, and one of my assignments was to teach technical writing. And I remember seeing technical, I thought, well, I better use some technology. So, alas, I went down to the computer lab, the new Mac computer lab, and I would often just sit by the student I thought looked to be the most efficient. I wasn't teaching the class. I would just go in, and then I would lean over, and if they did something interesting, I'd say, you know, how did you do that? And so then that was kind of how I learned these things. I never worried about breaking the machine. So when they were looking for an instructional designer, you know, and to teach faculty how to use the computer to teach online classes, then that just seemed to fit for me. I mean, I'm not sure how it happened. I just got a chip. It all made sense.
Hmm. You know, we recently had your son on the show, Dr. John Solberg, who grew up to be an emergency physician after going to school for studying agriculture. And I'm hearing so many parallels between the way that you interact with the world and the way that he interacts with the world, in that you just see something and you have a sort of a gut feeling connection to it, and you're curious and you want to learn more, but you're ready to just dive right in.
You know, I'll tell you an interesting little story about John and his mom and his dad. when he was still like in elementary school, we had a friend who was getting a master's degree in some kind of special ed program, and she had to practice giving some of the tests that she would give to students then as a teacher. She had to practice on some kids. So I said, well, you can practice on my kids. So there was one test that was called the Kaufman ABC test, and it was to see whether you were a spontaneous learner or a simultaneous learner. Mm-hmm. And the idea is that we all have a little of both, but we kind of lean in one direction. And one of the cartoons that was in the instructions to this test had a football coach who was looking at some kids, and at one of them, he said, okay, I want you to sit down, and I'm going to teach you how to play football. And he said, you know, first we do this, and then we do this, and then we do this.
Ooh, I'm out.
And then the other cartoon said, okay, you guys just get out on that field and play. So one night, my husband was a volunteer fireman, and we had gotten a new computer table. And so John and I were going to put the computer table together. And Dad said, well, don't do that while I'm gone, because I know you guys aren't going to follow the instructions. and we just kind of looked, and we said, please don't, because I know, you know, some of the threads are going to get stripped, and it's just not going to work, and I have to go. So we didn't say much, but he left, and of course we did not take the instructions out until we felt like we needed them, and we started calling them the destructions. You know, he and I we put the whole computer table together, and it was, you know, we just went in and fought our way through it.
Oh, I love it.
It was the same with practicing the piano. You know, I would sit down and practice with him, and I'd say, okay, let's do measure five first, because that looks to be the easiest one. And you see, that's the same as measure number 12. And finally, John said to me, you know, I don't want to practice with a dad anymore. He always makes me start at the beginning.
Oh.
And it was just realizing that we learn differently, and we attack problems or whatever we're going to do, we come at it differently. And so I would say that, you know, John and I are spontaneous learners, and Dad is more simultaneous. You do this first, second, third, and fourth. And that helped me even when I was teaching, because I realized that with students, sometimes I'd stand in front of the class and I would give all the instructions for how to do the homework. And there were probably 8 or 10 kids that had already started doing the homework, and they were probably on, you know, halfway done through with it. But some of them need to know step by step, and some of mm-hmm. them just want to say, just let me go and do it.
And there's room for all of them.
Mm-hmm.
Barb, thank you so much for your time today.
Well, thank you, Ashley. It was nice to visit with you.
Barb Solberg in a discussion about online learning with our Ashley Thornburg. Coming up on Main Street, Chuck Lura shares a natural North Dakota essay. And we'll talk with Carolyn Grimes, who played Jimmy Stewart's young daughter in the holiday classic, It's a Wonderful Life. First, the news.
For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster. Cass County Sheriff Jesse Johnner says he'll take complaints on the face covering requirement and bar restaurant occupancy limits on a case-by-case basis. Johnner says deputies will respond to complaints when possible, but other calls will take priority.
There's a lot of gray area when it comes to law enforcement. And so in each situation that we go to is going to be different. Are we going to be out running around issuing a lot of citations? No, we're not. Anything that we would have that would be egregious, we're certainly going to take a hard look at that and figure out what the best scenario is for that situation.
Violations under Governor Burgum's order could be charged as an infraction with a maximum fine of $1,000. Four sheriffs in western North Dakota say they have no plans to enforce the governor's executive order. New research is looking at how the controversial weed killer dicamba is spreading. Harvest Public Media's Jonathan All reports the new focus is at the molecular level.
Researchers at Washington University in St. Louis are examining how dicamba molecularly bonds with other chemicals sprayed at the same time. Some combos might add to the weed killer's drift away from the intended fields. Kimberly Parker is leading the study. She says increasing the knowledge of bonds in dicamba is a first step.
I think ultimately the work we're doing to build a better molecular picture, I think, would hopefully improve and inform the design of better chemicals.
Parker says more research will be needed to come up with better options for dicamba. Her team's initial findings were published in the journal Environmental Science and Technology. Jonathan All, Harvest Public Media.
And State Board of Higher Education member Casey Ryan is serving his first term on the board. That term expires at the end of June 2021, and he is eligible for a second term. Does he want to stay on the board?
Right now, the answer is yes.
Ryan chairs the board's Research and Governance Subcommittee, a role he enjoys.
It was to bring NDSU and UND closer together and then work with the other nine institutions to promote research within the state.
Ryan says he's seeing a lot of progress in that area.
If we could bring the two research universities functioning together, we move from institutions that have about 13, 14,000 students to a combined effort that is about 28,000. And when you have that bigger number, you can start competing for bigger grants and be competitive with larger institutions around the country. I think that is the goal.
And Ryan says there is a larger overall goal.
Make it the third stool of the North Dakota economy, the other two being agriculture and energy. So I think it's a very exciting time. I think opportunity is huge.
Ryan says the committee is drafting a plan to work with the legislature to advance the research plan. For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster.
Support is provided by Benedictine Living Center of Garrison, providing long-term skilled nursing care, short-stay rehabilitation, outpatient therapy, and assisted and independent living. A member of the Benedictine Health System, blcgarrison.com.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. Yesterday, four astronauts blasted off to the International Space Station in a spectacular night launch. For the better part of a century, we've been putting a human presence in space. Before that, the night sky was a place of deep mystery with occasional fireworks. Chuck Lura offers some history and science with today's Natural North Dakota essay about a meteor shower.
The Northern Torrids meteor shower began on October 20th and runs until December 10th. It's not one of our more well-known meteor showers, producing maybe 5 to 10 meteors per hour. It peaked on the evening of the 11th and early morning hours of the 12th, but there's still more to see, and the Northern Torrids are known to occasionally produce some unusually showy displays. Not only can we see the Northern Torrids, but the Leonids meteor shower has already started as well and will continue through the 30th. The Leonids is considered by many to be an average shower, with maybe 15 or so meteors per hour during the peak viewing period. This year, the peak will occur on the evening of the 16th and early morning hours of the 17th. Like the Northern Torrids, the sky should be dark enough to make for a good show. With the exception of at least one meteor shower caused by particles of an asteroid, meteor showers are produced by debris from comets. You may recall that comets are mixtures of ice, rock, and dust. They're like dirty snowballs or snowy dirt balls a few miles in diameter. When the comet passes near the sun, the heat causes the comets to shed ice and particles. These mostly sand-sized pieces of ice and rock create a debris field in outer space. When the Earth passes through these debris fields, the pieces collide with the atmosphere and become glowing hot, creating what we call falling stars or shooting stars. Of course, through much of human history, they were thought to be something completely different. Some cultures viewed falling stars as portending good, others a portent of doom. Some thought they were the souls of babies born coming to Earth from heaven, or perhaps the light of a falling star was the extinguishing of a human life. Seeing a falling star in some cultures meant you were going to die. Others would promptly bring the children in the house and sprinkle them with holy water upon seeing a falling star. We now know that we have little to fear from meteors, and seeing them is always a treat. So take some time over the next couple weeks and enjoy the show. I'm Chuck Lara.
Natural North Dakota is supported in part by the NDSU Central Grasslands Research Extension Center. You can read and hear today's story at prairiepublic.org.
On Prairie Public Primetime TV tonight.
Utilities don't like competition. They own your electricity. It's theirs. I'm uncovering a powerful system waging war against the solar industry.
This is a big threat.
They want to stop competition from solar.
I think that's just the way it has been.
That's the worst explanation.
It is definitely going to be an uphill battle.
Watch Independent Lens tonight at 9 Central, 8 Mountain on Prairie Public.
You're listening to Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton, joined now by Carolyn Grimes, better known as Zuzu Bailey from the classic holiday film It's a Wonderful Life. And she joins us from her home in California. Is that correct, Carolyn?
That's correct.
Well, let's talk about this classic movie. You were a youngster. You were 6 years old when you played the role of Zuzu Bailey. Did you recall any of the filming, or is that lost in the, you know, the cobwebs of memory?
Oh, no. It was a special film for me. And since 1980, I've been talking about it and reliving all that, digging up the memories. And so, yes, it's very, very fresh because I sort of live It's a Wonderful Life every day.
Well, it was a post-World War II film. It starred Jimmy Stewart and Donna Reed and Lionel Barrymore. It's just a wonderful cast. And, of course, Carolyn Grimes, that was your performing name at that time. How did you get into movies?
Well, I was 4 years old, and, you know, I lived in Hollywood, and pretty much all little kids were in the industry at that time out there in California. So it wasn't anything unusual or new, and so my mom just took me to see an agent. The agent liked me. She sent me on some interviews. I got some parts, and bingo, I was in.
Well, how would you compare your experience with the stereotype of child actors and stage moms?
Oh, it was wonderful. I had a wonderful experience. My mother was not the typical stage mom. I mean, she pushed me all right, but I never knew the people that I was working with, like Bing Crosby, Cary Grant, John Wayne. I never really knew they were stars. I really didn't know what stars were. So, I mean, it was like they were just normal people. So I think she made that a point for me so that I would act natural. And I wasn't pushed like a lot of other kids. I know when I went to the interview for It's a Wonderful Life, a mother, there were five of us little girls in the waiting room, and a mother accidentally spilled some coffee on my dress. And I didn't think anything about it. You know, it didn't bother me. And so I walked in and did my interview with Frank Capra, and it was all cool and good, you know, nothing bad. And so I didn't really think anything about it, but afterwards I heard my mother discussing it with one of the other moms, and they didn't think it was an accident. So there was a lot of that stuff that went on, but I was above that. I guess my mother protected me. I didn't know anything about it.
Well, I was intrigued when I looked into your background. I didn't realize that you had not seen the movie until Jimmy Stewart tracked you down and like 1980 or something like that.
That's right.
Well, what was it like seeing the movie after so many years?
Well, I'd seen bits and pieces of it, but I had just never sat down and watched the entire film to get the full meaning of the movie. And so that it was just incredible. I mean, I couldn't believe what I had missed and the fact that I hadn't seen it. And I regretted it because I should have brought my children up as using that as a Christmas tradition every year, like so many families did and do. But I didn't because I had never seen it. So, you know, know, I had seven kids, and I just didn't have time to watch a lot of TV, and it wasn't high on my priority list. I would get to maybe sit down and watch Johnny Carson. That was about it, because I lived in the kitchen, the laundry room, and the car. That was about it.
Jimmy Stewart had just returned from World War II. He was in the Army Air Corps and was an officer. When he takes this role, it's post-World War II, right fresh after the war. And I was surprised to see that the movie was first identified as a rom-com, not as this sort of inspirational holiday piece.
Oh, not at all. No. It was not a success when it came out. I mean, it was... The timing wasn't really great because it was right after World War II. People wanted to be entertained. They wanted to laugh. They wanted it to be light and something that was sort of applicable to the times. The movie that won the award that year was The Best Years of Our Lives, which was a movie about soldiers returning from the war and adjusting to civilization again. So it was... just bad timing, and it just wasn't, they weren't ready for a dark movie about a man who's going to commit suicide. And they didn't want to think. They wanted to be entertained. And this is a thinker. I mean, you got to admit that it is a thinker. And the beauty of it, that the gift from it after you think is absolutely magnificent, but they just weren't ready for it back then.
Well, you appeared with lots of very famous people. I mean, Jimmy Stewart, Donna Reed, Bing Crosby, Loretta Young, Cary Grant, Fred McMurray, Betty Grable, Danny Kaye. Who really stands out? What kind of memories do you have of these icons of the silver screen?
I'd have to say Jimmy Stewart, Bing Crosby, Cary Grant, and John Wayne. Those are the ones that I remember very, very well. They were just fabulous.
Well, you were in Rio Grande with John Wayne and Maureen O'Hara, and that was directed by John Ford, again, like Frank Capra, a pretty well-known name in Hollywood.
Yeah, but he was scary.
Well, as I understand it, didn't Maureen O'Hara once say that she thought some stuntmen were killed in a river scene on horses in that while making that movie?
I don't think so.
Oh, I hope not.
No, I don't think so.
Okay.
I think I would have heard about that.
Yeah.
I know she was very mad at him. She was furious with him, and she was really letting those four-letter words all out all over the place. Oh, she was mad. They had a big thing, and I ended up in the car with her coming, going back to the hotel, and she was cursing and carrying on, and her hairdresser said, you know, there's a child in the car. Well, I wasn't paying attention at all to what she said until the lady said that. And then I listened to everything. And believe me, she didn't stop. She still was assaulting John Ford in a great big way.
This movie, It's a Wonderful Life, is, of course, shot in Hollywood. So Bedford Falls, this snowy town at Christmas time is a pretty hot place in a film back lot, isn't it?
Yeah. The outside scenes were filmed at the Studio Ranch in Encino.
And so the snow was what?
Well, actually, it was a new process. Capra invented it. He and his cronies got together, and they invented this new way of making snow. And it was made with the fomite that firemen use and ivory soap flakes. And
wow,
that was silent snow for him, and that's what he wanted. He didn't want the previous way they made snow with cornflakes, and that they crunched so that they sprayed cornflakes, and that was what you saw flying through the air. He didn't want that. So he devised this new technique. They still use it today.
Your character's name is Zuzu Bailey. Where did Zuzu come from?
When Jimmy Stewart runs up the stairs, when he's coming back from his unborn sequence, he runs up the stairs, and I come out my door, and he says, Zuzu, my little ginger snap.
Oh.
And there was a product made called Zuzu's Ginger Snaps. It was a cookie. And it was made by the National Biscuit Company, which today is Nabisco. And that's where the name came from.
Wow.
So I was named after a cookie.
Well, Zuzu Bailey is Carolyn Grimes in real life, and she appeared at the age of 6 in It's a Wonderful Life with Jimmy Stewart and Donna Reed. This is a classic. I've seen it maybe 100 times. I'm sure many of our listeners have as well. The story of your life, though, has a tragic turn when you're rather young. What happened?
Well, I was orphaned at the age of 15, and the court in Hollywood sent me to a little town in Missouri, and I just lived there. I mean, from Los Angeles, Hollywood, to a town of 800, a farming town. I thought I'd died for a while, but I never went back to California nor that lifestyle. So I learned about real people, the Midwest, and I liked it. And I decided never to go back.
Sounds like you found your own Bedford Falls.
Well, in a way, I did.
You appeared in early television, too. That would have been quite a different process back then. I assume that they used multiple cameras and then just transferred it right to film. Did you have to learn lines like a play then, or how did it work for you?
Yeah, I just learned my lines, just like a movie. You just study your lines, and that's it.
Do you have other memorable performances that you recall besides the movie It's a Wonderful Life, some scenes that really stick with you?
Yeah, in The Bishop's Wife, I have some. I was and of course, Blue Skies with Bing Crosby was pretty memorable. But you know what? I really loved being in the Westerns. I loved riding in the wagons and you know, all the stagecoaches and all. I was in a movie with Randolph Scott called Albuquerque, and I got to ride as Shotgun on the stagecoach with Gabby Hayes.
I mean, wow.
It was just so much fun.
I remember Gabby Hayes. What a character he was, even on television. He was a classic sidekick.
Oh, yeah. He was great. And he was a nice man. And he was very intelligent, very well educated. Great guy.
What did you do after acting? I mean, you moved to Missouri. You go to school.
Well, I became a medical technologist.
And what was that? What did you do?
I worked at a hospital. And then I started working at doctor's offices. And so that was kind of what I did with my life. And I ended up in Kansas City. I worked for one clinic for many years, and then I retired when I was 40, and that's when It's a Wonderful Life started coming around, and so then I totally devoted my life to It's a Wonderful Life, and that's what I've been doing since 1980. I've been on the road since 1993.
You were actually going to be appearing in Bismarck with
yes.
It's a Wonderful Life, an evening with Zuzu that was put on by Zarel's Jewelry, but they canceled it because of the pandemic. And I assume that you're talking about them perhaps with them about doing it another time.
Well, I think maybe next Thanksgiving weekend. So that's just a tentative arrangement, but I think that's when we're going to do it.
Well, good.
Because I want to come there. I want to see Zarel's, and I want to really meet him. He's a wonderful man. He's so kind and so generous, and I just feel so bad that I wasn't able to meet the people this year. But I will next year, and maybe this curse will be gone, and I can actually meet the people.
You know, you mentioned Jimmy Stewart tracking you down as secretary back in 1980, and since then, It's a Wonderful Life, of course, has become an important part of your life. How about the other kid actors in that movie? Do you still get together with them, or do you know what they're up to?
Oh, sure, absolutely. Yeah, we've been together the Target Company brought us together in 1993, and we've been together ever since then. And so we're like brother and sister for real. And then every year I started an It's a Wonderful Life festival in Seneca Falls, New York. And we have been getting together back there every year at Christmas. So I for sure see them then, and I see them other times too sometimes. So It's like I have my own family.
You've got a website. I can tell our listeners that it's easy to find. It's zuzu.net. And up there you've got a little biography of yourself and some products that are sold that relate to It's a Wonderful Life, including, is there a cookbook that you wrote?
Oh, yes. Uh-huh.
And what's that based on?
Actually, when I moved to the Midwest, I didn't get to live with very nice people. They were kind of bad. And they more or less took everything that belonged to me that was my parents' things and so forth and so on. Anything that was special, they kept. So when the lady died that I had lived with about 10 years, I don't know, 15 years ago, I called her daughter and I said, I know that she has my mother's recipe box and I want it because I know you have it now. So she sent it to me and I got to reading all those wonderful recipes and they kind of brought back home and I decided this is just a lot of love and I'm going to share it with people. So that's what I did.
The recipe for It's a Wonderful Life cookbook is the name of the book. And there's also, because the movie is such a part of our holiday tradition now, last year there was a reissue of the movie as a 4K Blu-ray version of the movie, which would mean it would be spectacularly sharp, probably sharper than when it was projected in 1947.
Oh, way more, way more. And now there's a new steel case version for collectors. It came out this year. So it's clear, it's beautiful. Oh my, it's like you're right there.
And there's a colorized version. I know a lot of purists prefer the black and white original.
Well, I like the color.
Yeah, it pops. That's for sure.
Oh, yes. You see so much more in the background. You see so much more in the way of facial expressions and things like that. I love the color.
How long did it take to shoot the movie?
3 months.
Why do you think this movie has had such a lasting impression on audiences?
I think because of the messages of hope that the movie offers. And I think that every time you watch that movie, it lifts your spirits and gives you back some self-confidence that you might have lost over the year. And it's a movie that appeals to everyone. And they realize when they watch the movie that George Bailey made a huge impact, even though he didn't know it, and that we can do that too. But also, you learn about giving and the joy that comes within you from giving. And I don't know, there's just so many messages of hope in the movie, and it makes you feel like you matter. So a lot of people watch it every year at Christmas time just to lift their spirits.
Well, George Bailey's story in the film, he goes from the depths of despair to unbridled joy. And you have, I think, the last line in the movie, don't you? Just about?
Just about.
What is that famous line?
Daddy, teacher says, every time a bell rings, an angel gets his wings.
Well, Carolyn Grimes, thank you for spending time with us today.
Well, thank you for having me.
And we look forward to your visit to Bismarck next November, maybe. Okay.
Yes, yes, yes.
All the best to you.
Thank you.
Dakota Datebook is next.
Support is provided by Dr. Julie Peterman Bryant of the Bryant Clinic of Chiropractic and Acupuncture in Bismarck. Naturally working with people to feel better, be healthy, and live well.
This is Dakota Datebook for November 16th. News from around the state on this date. In 1894, Pheasanton was itching to take over the Wells County seat, which they took from Sykeston 10 days earlier. Sykeston lost the election fair and square, but things weren't moving fast enough for some. So, a number of Pheasanton residents took 20 wagons to Sykeston and forcibly took possession of county records. These other events on this date came from 1911. In Botno, 5 prisoners escaped from jail after returning to their cells from supper.
This was the second time they had broken out that week. In Kenmare, a pile of burning garbage got out of hand, and the fire department was brought out. When one of the firemen brought along a ladder, someone asked why he needed a ladder when the fire was on the ground. He said that to ring the fire bell, he had to move the ladder, and he decided to bring it along for company. And in Grand Forks, crop yields were so high that they ran out of railroad cars. In Cavalier County, Thorson Sabe got 104 bushels of oats to the acre, and George Fassler got 53 bushels of barley per acre. Near Bantry, the Laser brothers got 3,000 bushels of flax from 200 acres. At $2 a bushel, they made $6,000. In Pembina County, 22-year-old farmer Alan Andres harvested 36 acres, including 900 bushels of oats, 1,500 bushels of potatoes, 71 bushels of beans, and 70 bushels of barley. He made a total of $1,820, or $53.33 an acre, and that was a fantastic amount for the time. The record-breaking year for crops made North Dakota the state with the highest income per capita in the nation at $1,931. And while the population of the United States had increased 21% in the previous 10 years, North Dakota's population had increased a whopping 80%. The state also had the lowest death rate in the Union. And the last of our news, but certainly not the least, the Hansborough newspaper reported on the latest invention for the home, the gum board. It was designed to hang on the dining room wall. The name of each family member was painted around the edge to mark the spot where they could stick their gum until they wanted to chew it again. Today's Dakota Datebook was written by Mary Helm. I'm Merrill Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from Humanities North Dakota.
China banned all fentanyl-related compounds more than a year ago, but that hasn't stopped users from obtaining chemicals used to make the opioid if they know where to look.
Vendors will rarely use the actual name for a drug, so you're not going to necessarily see an advertisement that says fentanyl for sale.
A devastating drug problem persists on the next morning edition from NPR News.
Starting at 4 a.m. Central, right here on Prairie Public.
Thank you for joining us today for Main Street. As you know, we stream at prairiepublic.org as we broadcast. And after the show, you can find any Main Street program at prairiepublic.org as a podcast. Tuesday on our show, Prairie Public News Director Dave Thompson will talk with State Mineral Resources Director Lynn Helms about the use of millions of dollars of CARES Act relief funds for the state's oil industry. It's part of his ongoing series titled Energy Issues and Answers, Oil Well Reclamation. We hope you can join us for Main Street on Tuesday. In the meantime, enjoy the rest of your day.